Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we speak to an author who has written a biography of Maverick filmmaker Russ Meyer. We hear about Shakespeare's naughty side. We talk to a plant biologist who has started a website featuring the strangest of the strange of the plant kingdom. And former Cubs and Cardinals players take the field again for a special game. Those stories and more, this time on Sidetrack. Beyond the steroid scandal, multi-million dollar salaries, and lucrative product endorsements, baseball is still a game, one that many who now make the big bucks played for fun the same way many of us did when we were kids. Some big league heroes in the 1980s recently took to the diamond in Joliet expressly for that purpose. Jeff Bossert was among the spectators.
3 years ago, the Jackhammers arrived in the heart of downtown Joliet. The city's construction of Silver Cross Field for the independent minor league club was one in a series of incentives undertaken to improve the city's economic and social climate. The baseball team has drawn well in its first 3 seasons, producing a winner 2 of those years. Jackhammer general manager Steve Malliott has also sought out the help of former big leaguers to lure fans. He's the former GM of an Atlanta Braves minor league club based in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
We did a Legends game, mixed more National League versus American League stars. It wasn't specific Cubs, White Sox, or anything like that. But, you know, we started it there, and it was successful, and we kind of found a model that works, a business model, and now we employ that here, and it's been very successful.
And now here is the roster for the Cubs.
With the Jackhammers out of town, more than 6,000 fans filled Silver Cross Field for the stadium's second-ever exhibition contest, the I-55 Classic, a game made up almost entirely of former Cubs and Cardinals players.
You gotta love it when they shoot T-shirts into the crowd, you know? Especially out of a giant hot dog. Doesn't get any better than that.
It was the standing-room-only crowd for Luke Scaccinoci, a Joliet native whose employer, a local carpet company, sponsors the minor league team.
I'm normally a Cubs fan, but, you know, tonight the boss is playing for the Cardinals.
Number 29, Jose Arnell.
I told my boss, I said, you know, when I got a job with you, if my friends would have known that you were a Cardinals fan, they'd have never let me work here for you. But since that's only 2 people, it'll let it slide.
These are teams made up almost entirely of retired major leaguers. While some of the players filling out the Cardinals roster were former minor leaguers, others included Lee Bailey of Bailey's Carpet One, Scaccinoci's boss, a couple of Pepsi distributor employees, and a local radio DJ. Another on the former Cubs team won his roster spot on eBay. The game took on the slow pace of a traditional old-timers contest. All due respect to a group of retirees mostly in their late 40s to mid-50s, there wasn't much action early on. The Cub bats remained silent, while former Cub pitcher Rick Rushel tossed 4 scoreless innings.
Do they have the radar gun on you guys?
I hope not. I don't think it registers that low.
Rushel pitched for 19 seasons, including a 20-win campaign with the Cubs in 1977 and a World Series appearance with San Francisco after beating the Cubs in 1989. But he says the longevity was an honor in itself.
I was able to play for a long time. I got to play early in my career against Mays and Aaron, and I got to play with Billy Williams and Ron Santo and Fergie Jenkins, and to me, that's probably the highlights of my career. Very fortunate.
Former White Sox infielder Kelly Dransfeld, who retired from professional baseball last year at the age of 29, clubbed a 3-run homer in the top of the 5th inning. Dransfeld, a Joliet native, was used sparingly in 4 seasons with the White Sox and Texas Rangers.
You know, I'm very satisfied with my career, and it's just fun to come out here and just play for fun again when, you know, back when you're on the little league field and, you know, just out there for fun, and there's not a whole lot of pressure out here.
Dransfeld, who later tacked on 2 RBI singles in the game, is going back to school. He'll earn his degree in business management in May. Meanwhile, Russell's counterpart on the mound, former Cardinal starter Bob Forsch, was equal to the task, throwing five scoreless innings. Forsch, who won a World Series title with the Cardinals in 1982, says those now donning the uniform he wore in the 70s and 80s, like St. Louis's Albert Pujols, or any other young ballplayer for that matter, have brought a different look and sense of excitement to the game.
I think the athletes are better. I think they take better, you know, better care of themselves than we did.
Happy, Brian.
And, you know, I don't know. There's a reason that they're hitting more home runs. It's, you know, it's not all to do with drugs and all that stuff.
But,
you know, I think the athletes are just better prepared now than probably when we played.
Back on the field, the classic Cardinals weren't nearly done with Ransfeld's homer. Cards players continued to feast on the pitching of former Cub Milt Pappas. And it was 9-0 Redbirds by the end of the sixth inning. The Cubs didn't break through until former outfielder Keith Moreland hit a three-run shot. Now broadcasting football for the University of Texas Longhorns, Moreland says one of the greatest honors of his 12-year career was putting a quality product on the diamond at Wrigley Field again.
I mean, I really feel like that our 83, 84, 85 team sort of set the program to where it is now, where it's a packed house. When I first played here in 82, we had 30,000 opening day and 1,500 the second day. So to see the changeover to where we started putting people in the stands, that's a fun of being a part of that changeover.
The game fell out of reach late as the Cardinals tacked on 9 runs in the final 3 innings, but few in the field or stands really cared about the final outcome, an 18-4 clubbing of the former Cubs. What brought out the fans was perhaps an autograph and a chance to see their heroes in action again. And for the players, a chance to catch up with the guys they used to work with for nearly 8 months each year. Another Joliet native, former pitcher Steve Parrish of the Cardinal team, says he's never lost sight of the fact that he and many teammates spent their summers playing a game.
Playing in the big leagues is fun. And if anybody tells you any different, you know, they're crazy. It's definitely work. People don't realize that it is your job, and it is a lot of work to get to where you're at and stay there. But it's a good time, and I wouldn't give it up for anything.
In Joliet, I'm Jeff Bossert.
You're listening to Sidetrack. Think of the great museums of the Great Lakes regions, and chances are you'll think of Chicago's Art Institute, the Field Museum, or in downstate Illinois, the Lincoln Library in Springfield, and the Crandon Art Museum in Champaign. But you know, there is so much more out there. There are dozens of unusual museums in the region. Just ask Christine Dagerin. She compiled a guide called Great Little Museums of the Midwest. She was recently a guest on WILL's Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
It's good to get off the beaten path, isn't it?
It is. It is. I had a lot of fun traveling and trying to find these museums. I started out with a list of maybe about 25 museums in Wisconsin and Illinois, parts of Indiana and Iowa. And I found that as I traveled around, my list grew probably 3 times, because every time I would stop at a museum, people would refer me to other little stops. And have you heard about so-and-so? Or my cousin John collects tractors, and, you know, he's got a museum up, you know, so-and-so place. So it was a fun time.
Yeah, Yeah. In the introduction to this guide, Great Little Museums of the Midwest, you say we can get a sense of the Midwest's character through its museums. So what do these small, specialized museums tell us about ourselves as Midwesterners?
Well, I found that there are different categories of museums in the Midwest, at least the small ones, and they tend to follow certain themes. We have the agricultural museums, where they have the threshing machines and the combines and, you know, all the antique tractors. And so there's the ones that tell us about the area's rural heritage. And then you have the museums dedicated to the famous people that lived in, or grew up in the Midwest. There's a James D. Museum in Indiana. There's a Chester Gould and Dick Tracy Museum in Woodstock, which is just northwest of Chicago. And he, Chester Gould, was a cartoonist, and they have a museum dedicated to him because he lived in Woodstock. And there are museums dedicated to the major companies that were headquartered in the Midwest, or still are. Probably one of the more famous ones is the McDonald's Museum in Des Plaines. But there's also a Dr. Scholl's and a Feet First Museum in Chicago, which is really fun because it talks a little bit about how the Dr. Scholl's company came about, but also has vintage shoes on display from around the world and in the Midwest too. Very large shoes and very tiny shoes. So, and there are a number of museums. Probably the ones that are the most fun to visit are the ones curated by people that had hobbies that kind of got away from them. There's a woman in Lamont, Illinois, which is southwest of Chicago, and her name is Lucille Hodges Bomerick, and she has a cookie jar museum. And her story was fascinating. I think she gave me a quote saying that collectors are born and not made. And she was completing an alcoholism, a 12-step program, and her sponsor said, you should start traveling or you should start collecting something. And so she got into collecting cookie jars, and you know, it was 10, 20 years later, she had hundreds and hundreds of them. So they're...
It's amazing the variety of people and things that are explored and or celebrated or, you know, in these museums all over the Midwest.
There's another place I'm thinking about in Dale, Indiana, Dr. Ted's Musical Marvels. And he's a family doctor, and in his spare time, he got into collecting piano players and all these different kinds of musical players. And, you know, after so many years, he had such a vast collection of them, and he restored them. And so he opened up this museum, and it's a hoot. It's a lot of fun. They play all the music for you. So,
well, tell us about Barry Levinson and the Mustard Museum.
Barry was a lawyer in Boston, and it was many years ago, and he was distraught over the Red Sox losing. And his story was that he was going through the supermarket and shopping and saw some mustard on the shelves and said, and got this idea to collect a mustard and display them and sell them in a little town called Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, which is about a half an hour from Madison. And it's a great little suburb of Madison, and it's got hundreds and hundreds of mustards and antique mustard pots from France, and they sell mustard too, and they have mustard tastings. And I think he's even written a book praising mustard and the history of mustard. So
if the Boston Red Sox couldn't cut mustard, Barry would do it.
Right.
And there's a film there you can see about mustard. Mustard Peace Theater.
Yes.
Wow. Now, is his passion, in his case, mustard, found in others who have started a museum, like the woman with the cookie jars and the musical instruments?
A lot of the collectors are just, they're really passionate, and they just love things. There's a number of collectors of cars and antique cars, and there's a gentleman up in Fountain City, Wisconsin, which is Fountain City. It's just right along the Mississippi River. And I was driving along doing a Great River Road trip and came across Elmer's. In fact, I heard about it at a gas station, and they said, oh, you have to go up to Elmer's, and you have to drive up this to the top of this mountain, practically, there, this bluff that overlooks the city. And he has like three different sheds of antique cars, pedal cars, miniature tin toys. And his story was he was a mechanic, and so he, over the years, just collected and restored, and so he's got tons and tons of...
Yeah.
He's got a Model T car.
Among the more unusual museums that you've run across in your travels, the Museum of Questionable Medical Devices in Minneapolis. Now, what kind of questionable devices will we find at that particular museum?
That was probably one of my favorite museums. And I've told that it closed recently. I have to call and find out, which would be a real loss because it was a really fun place. I remember they had one corner devoted to radium and how people believed that radium would treat their it could, you know, improve their health. And so there would be like these pre-mixed drink, radium drinks. But they also had gas igniters that you would put them on, say your legs ached, and you would shock yourself, and supposedly you would cure yourself. And they had a lot of, you know, devices that claimed you could that would make you lose weight. I think phrenology type of devices where you could read the bumps on your head and they would tell you about what you were destined to do in your life. And the best part of that museum was it was very hands-on, and the owner, Bob McKay, would go over and he would take the devices out from the glass cases and demonstrate them to you. And so it was a fun place. And yeah. He was a neat guy.
If we were kids, little kids, is there a particular museum that we would find?
Well, locally, there's the Raggedy Ann and Andy Museum down in Arcola, and that's probably about, 5 years old, or it's somewhat recently opened up. And she has many dolls on display, but also a discussion and displays on the life of Johnny Gorel, who was the creator of the dolls, and talks about how that whole idea generated and the evolution of those dolls into sort of iconic and collector's items for many people.
And she's related to Johnny Gruelle.
I believe so. I think she may be a granddaughter. I'm not sure, but I know that she was related to him. And he lived in Arcola, that area, for a year or two. But she felt that Arcola made a good location for that museum because it is a downtown, hometown type of place in the heartland. So that's a good place for kids. Yeah.
That was Christine Degaren, author of a new guide titled Great Little Museums of the Midwest. She was talking with Celeste Quinn as part of AM580's Afternoon Magazine. You've got it tuned to Sidetrack. Many people spend the spring and summer months maintaining gardens and flower beds, but the plants that Dan Nickrent deals with are like nothing you've ever seen. Nickrent is a professor of plant biology at Southern Illinois University Carbondale, and he has created a virtual garden online featuring dozens of examples of parasitic plants, plants that feed off of other organisms and look like they belong on another planet. The most unusual of these have blooms that can reach 3 feet in diameter, can weigh up to 25 pounds, and smell like rotten meat. I talked with Nick Rent recently and asked him first to give us a thumbnail sketch of what parasitic plants are.
Yeah, parasitic plants are often confused with other plants that people see that they think are parasites, but in a strict botanical sense, a parasitic plant is one that attaches to another plant, physically attaches to it, and actually gets its nutrients from that plant. So we know of things like mistletoe that grow up in the trees. They're actually attached to the branch of the tree and have derived their nutrients from that tree. So they are truly a parasite. Now, this is different than things like Spanish moss that you'll see that's a member of the pineapple family, and those droop from the branches of trees. People see them, and they may call them parasites, but they're not actually deriving any nutrients from the host tree, if you will. The host is simply a support for them because they can just as well grow on a power line as they can on that tree.
So can these parasitic plants be found all over the world, or are they just in particular regions of the world?
Yeah, they're pretty much worldwide, except for the very coldest places on Earth, the Arctic and the Antarctic. You wouldn't find them. But my gosh, way down in the southern tip, Tierra del Fuego of South America, there's tiny little parasitic plants. And way up north in, you know, Finland and Scandinavia, there are parasitic plants. So it's pretty much anywhere you go, you can find them.
Now, do they serve a purpose in their ecosystem?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of them, we're just beginning to learn some about this, that they actually are what we call keystone species, especially mistletoes. Australia is very rich with mistletoes. The people there know them very well because they're a dominant landscape feature. They're so common. And we're finding out that they serve a very important role in terms of wildlife, because many bird species not only depend on them for the nectar in the flowers, but also the fruits. And they're important vectors that disperse the fruits. And so we find that when you remove mistletoes, and a colleague of mine has done the experimental work that shows that if you remove those mistletoes, you decrease the diversity of the animal fauna dramatically. And so these aren't just sort of curiosities. These are very important, as we say, keystone species to keep that ecosystem intact.
Now, you have set up a website which features the strangest of the strange of these parasitic plants. How did this website come about, and what are some of the plants that you feature?
Mm-hmm. The website began, oh gosh, back in the early 1990s, about 93 or so. And it began as sort of a self-serving way for me to keep track of all the information. And it sort of evolved after that into something more elaborate because people began to contribute images and information, and it began to grow. And so now, basically, it's a clearinghouse of information on all parasitic plants, not just the weird ones, but also some very beautiful ones. Some of these are wildflowers that people would see even in central Illinois. You know, the Indian paintbrush of your prairies is a parasitic plant, the genus Castilesia, and that one occurs commonly throughout North America. But it also contains, as you said, the weirdest of the weird. Some of these are such strange plants that we even, when they were first described, missed the kingdom. They were described as fungi. They looked so different from a typical flowering plant. Things like Hydnora of Africa and Balanophora of the tropics. These are plants that are so reduced and so modified from normal typical green plants that we missed the kingdom altogether early on in the 1800s.
So describe this one plant for me, and I hope I say this right,
Rafflesia. Yeah,
I can't even say it right.
Yeah, Rafflesia, sometimes called the queen of the parasites, is a very interesting one that occurs in Southeast Asia, Malaysia, Philippines. And it's a non-photosynthetic plant that doesn't photosynthesize. It has no green tissues whatsoever. It also lacks leaves, stems, roots. All there really is inside the host vine, which is a member of the grape family, a strand, we call it the endophyte, that grows inside the bark. And then at various intervals, every 5 to 8 years, it forms a flower bud. And that bud starts out small, size of a ping pong ball, and it's the size of a grapefruit. Then it's the size of a cabbage, and it bursts through the host bark and unfolds into a flower a meter, 3 feet in diameter, that may weigh 15 pounds. This is the largest flower in the world, and that's why she's called the queen of the parasites. And that's really all we see above, you know, outside of the vine. You can't really see any other parts of the plant. And so this is one of the most spectacular examples in the plant kingdom. Many people, you know, wait their whole lives to be able to see a Rafflesia. I call it the charismatic megaflora, kind of like charismatic megafauna of white rhinos and pandas. This is the equivalent in the plant world.
Have you ever seen one in real life?
Yes, I visited Malaysia several years back and was able to see a couple of species of Rafflesia, Rafflesia pricei, which is about the size of a dinner plate, and Rafflesia arnoldii, which is the one that's very large. The one I saw was nearly 3 feet in diameter. So, yeah, they're spectacular plants, one of those events in your life you certainly hope to be able to do, and that's one of them. I've got my botanical visits all checked out of what I need to do in my life, and that was one of them.
Well, what is it like to you know, hunt through, I'm guessing these are in jungles?
Yes.
To hunt through and then and find this huge, crazy, non-green plant.
Yeah. In this case, I was led to it by a guide, and luckily it's in a preserve. So some of the places in Malaysia are set aside because of these plants. So this was actually in the Crocker Range of Borneo, where they've actually got a Rafflesia reserve. So it wasn't too difficult to find it under those conditions. But in other places, strangely enough, we're discovering new ones. In the Philippines, there a couple years ago, a new species of Rafflesia was named, never before seen. So it just shows how unexplored these tropical forests really are. We think we've got it all nailed down and understood, but there are still new things to be discovered, including big flowers like Rafflesia.
So is there any thought of turning this virtual garden you have into a real garden?
Mm-hmm. Interesting you should bring that up. I met a young chap, an undergraduate, believe it or not, in Germany at the meetings, and this guy has become a real green thumb for parasitic plants. I mean, the number he's growing is just phenomenal, and he keeps asking for seeds and so on of different and more unusual ones to try his hand at culturing them. And in some cases, we've never cultured any of these plants. There's no evidence, for example, there's no known information on a seedling of Rafflesia attaching to its host. We have no photographs, no documentation. So there's very little known about this. And some of them have never been grown in cultivation. So it's not an easy prospect because we really don't know a lot about the basic biology of them. And that really brings us back to, you know, that just sequencing their genes isn't enough. We need to actually get into studying their biology and doing a lot more field work and observational work to figure out what's going on in nature.
Wow. Well, if people want to go look at your virtual garden, the one that is available on the web, what's that website?
Yes, it's called the Parasitic Plant Connection. And by just typing in the word parasitic plant on a Google search, you'll hit it. I think it may be the very first hit. So it's not very difficult to find, just knowing the words parasitic plant.
That was Dan Nickrent, a professor of plant biology from Southern Illinois University, Carbondale. We were talking about his website, which features a strange collection of parasitic plants. You can find a link to his website on the Sidetrack page of the WILL website, will.uiuc.edu. Still to come on the program, an interview with the author of a recent biography of filmmaker Russ Meyer, the man who made such films as Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, and Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. Over the centuries, William Shakespeare's insight into human nature and well-drawn characters have helped his plays achieve the status of classics. And while we may keep them on a literary pedestal, there is one element of Shakespeare that's decidedly earthy: his bawdy and unbridled insults. Laura Kennedy looks into the appeal of Shakespeare's naughty side.
Thou crusty botch of nature, lewd minx, thou detestable maw. When William Shakespeare wanted to insult, he didn't hold back. There's no denying the beauty and poetry of his words, but nestled into all that loveliness is a bard with bite. The wide range and lack of banality in his insults have granted them immortal status, raising eyebrows and chuckles since Elizabeth I sat on the throne. According to Illinois State University English professor Tori Thompson, compared to Shakespeare's day, we're more limited in the types of humor that we can use. While scatological humor is still used, racist, homophobic, and sexist humor is frowned on. Not so in the Elizabethan era. Thompson says we can get a thrill from Shakespeare's insults in part because they're wildly inappropriate today.
You can laugh while somebody else says it because you can't say it. So you get that sort of vicarious junior high thing. You get the rush of people saying things that are sort of forbidden in the culture that you live in.
One thing that seems to be very popular in modern culture is website Shakespearean insult generators. Simply Googling Shakespeare insults returns over 100,000 sites that allow you to build your own insult. You simply pick one word from three columns, like a Chinese menu. And as Illinois Shakespeare Festival actors David Quartermeyer and Cal McLean demonstrate, create your own Shakespearean insult.
Thou bawdy, pot-rooting package.
Thou puny, plume-plucked knot-hook.
Thou slobbery, slippery slop-thrower.
Thou tottering, tardy-gated varlet.
Thou son of a sonless slobber-butt.
While you can pretty much tar anyone with the insult generators, Shakespeare had his own favorite targets, says Tori Thompson. Lawyers, fools, and the clergy were frequently on the receiving end of his biting wit, and without apology.
In Shakespeare's world, there's nothing wrong with saying the most insulting possible things you can say. It was so okay to say pretty much anything.
Shakespeare also reveals a fondness for drunkards who, says actors Cal McLean and David Quartermeyer, are filled with colorful language.
They don't have an edit button. They just say what's on their mind.
We talk about the timeless quality of Shakespeare, and this is a classic example of that. It's still funny because it's still real to us. I mean, we recognize this.
Shakespeare was an actor as well as a playwright, and Quartermeyer and McLean both feel that that had bearing on the development of the texts and sometimes lewd and rude insults.
I'm sure they had a great time working on these scripts, because I understand that while Shakespeare wrote much of this, it was at times a true collaboration with his company in terms of
ad-libbing, developing stuff. It feels that way. Mm-hmm. It feels that way. It feels as if there's a lot of spontaneity and improvisation in it.
The insults in Shakespeare's texts are a kind of great equalizer, says ISU English professor Tori Thompson. Because plays like Twelfth Night use some arcane language, the bard is considered to be more of an intellectual type of entertainment. But when we laugh at the insults, we all become part of the club.
Part of why people like insults is because they're really heavily gesture cued and voice cued. So you kind of know somebody's insulting somebody even if you don't necessarily exactly know what it means. So you can laugh and you feel like you've got it. For modern audiences, and it's not because people are stupid, it's because it's 400-year-old English. So when you've got somebody going to the Shakespeare Festival and they don't understand half of what's being said, and then they hear an insult and they get it, it makes them comfortable. And they feel like they're with it, they know what's going on. So I think it's inclusive in that sense.
Cal McLean and David Quartermeyer also feel that the internet and its abundance of Shakespearean insult generators are helping to break down the barriers between the bard and the audience, allowing anyone to experience the exuberance of insulting Shakespeare style.
We can use a little bit of help from Shakespeare's ability to coin words, to come up with things like pox-marked and mold warp. And, you know, if we can drop those into casual conversation, we too can be looked at as something really special.
A scholar, perhaps.
Yeah. Or if nothing else, a funny guy.
Cal McLean recommends Pangloss.com for those who want to get started insulting the Shakespeare way. There's also an abundance of books full of rude Shakespeare quotes for the ambitious insulter. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You're listening to Sidetrack. From the late 1950s and going through the 1970s, exploitation filmmaker Russ Meyer brought to the screen films that were amped up with various combinations of sex and violence. Vixen, Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, Beyond the Valley of the Dolls. These are just some of the films that helped Meyer become one of the great cult film directors. The life and career of Meyer is told in a new biography by Jimmy McDonough. It's titled Big Bosoms and Square Jaws. The publisher is Crown Books. I talked with McDonough recently and asked him why he feels Meyer is one of the great unsung movie mavericks.
A complete original, this guy. I mean, no one was doing what he did before he did it. And he did it with a personal flair that had kind of a touch of madness to it, if you ask me. And it really changed film history. I mean, the idea of combining sexuality, his sense of sexuality, with technical expertise, and just his odd view of the world, it added up to a kind of movie that only he could make and hasn't been seen since, in my opinion.
For those people who aren't familiar with his work, tell us about some of his most famous movies.
Oh, certainly. The first movie that Meyer made a splash with was The Immoral Mr. Tees, which concerned the bumbling adventures of a voyeur who had the magic power to see through women's clothes. You look at this movie today, it's kind of an innocuous piece of piffle. At the time, it was hot stuff, and there was more sort of raw nudity and very kind of exuberant and unapologetic nudity, and it really put America's hair in curlers. And Russ did about, I don't know, 5-6 knockoffs of that. And then in 64, he came back with another kind of picture, Lorna, which was sort of like a grim black and white picture that actually told a story, was heavy on the violence. A real malevolent kind of air permeates the picture. And that began the great period of his black and white pictures, which culminates in a picture that's just beyond belief called Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill, the story of three murderous go-go dancers that are out for blood and money, and has influenced a bevy of filmmakers and rockers. Well, after that comes a color picture called Vixen with Erica Gavin, in which he amped up the sex to a really florid amount and made a picture that made a zillion bucks. And on the basis of the success of that, he was invited over to 20th Century Fox to do a picture scripted by one Roger Ebert, America's famous thumb, called Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, and another sort of like Faster Pussycat, a culmination of Meyer that is really, there's no movie quite like it. I couldn't even begin to describe it. But I'm sure your listeners out there have bumped into one or another of these movies or have heard of them. And then throughout the 70s, he made a handful of other pictures, most notably, I think, Super Vixens, which was maybe the most amped up version of his sort of drive-in style, very funny, colorful, fast-moving piece of Americana that, you know, there's just nothing like it.
Well, that's a great overview of his career, and let's go back a little bit and
Certainly.
Sort of get this all pieced out here.
Okay.
He started his career as a combat photographer in World War II.
Right.
And that profoundly influenced the rest of his life.
Oh, you said it. I mean, he really looked at movies, making movies, as an extension of his combat adventures. And believe you me, the people who were in them readily agreed. I mean, he'd take a cast and crew out to the middle of some godforsaken desert, and with six people, you know, a couple of strippers, some army buddies, and maybe even the occasional real actor, he'd grind out a movie. And he really, everybody said he was really sort of aping his adventures in the military, because that was really the formative experience that changed. I mean, it got him out of his home life, which from my research wasn't altogether the most happy, and it gave him an identity, it made him an adult, and you know, it introduced him to women for the first time overseas. So all that just sort of created an explosion in Russ's mind, and it led to many other things.
And once he got out of the war, he started doing industrial films, and that influence shows up as well in his
movies. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. John Waters, who was a great, great fan, friend, and I just obsessed with everything Meyer, called Meyer's picture Sex Industrials. And I think that's really an apt term, because you look at Meyer's pictures and there's just this unrelenting rat-a-tat-tat editing style, you know, a neon sign, a car fender, the inevitable breasts, a close-up of a pair of lips. And really, this is rooted in that industrial film style that he obviously became a master of, because he uses it to such diabolical ends in his filmmaking. It's just perfecto, in my opinion.
Well, there's one bit in the book where you talk about his editing style, and one of the rules, the laws, I guess, of the Meyer editing style was, don't show people blinking.
Oh, I'm so glad you mentioned that. Yeah, when I heard that, it just really kind of made me chuckle. Yeah, apparently he had a real mania for not showing any human being on screen blinking. He just thought it violated his aesthetic. And so at least one of his a couple people had told me, you know, it really was kind of one of the things that defined his editorial style, because if somebody was going to blink, he cut away. And in fact, one of his assistants would go to the movies while he worked for Meyer, and he went and saw some big Hollywood movie, and he said, man, there was a lot of blinking in that picture. It really, the editing wasn't very good. So, you know, once again, only Meyer could come up with this notion.
Well, besides the technical side, the editing and that sort of technical part of the movie making,
yeah.
He had this overarching philosophy, of which the title of your book sort of captures that, Big Bosoms and Square Jaws. That seemed to be a life philosophy of Meyer.
That's right. No, that was for him. That was the ingredients for a successful picture as made by Russ Meyer. And he certainly found, at least for him, when he deviated from that formula, it was big trouble.
Well, explain this formula, this philosophy, a little bit more.
Well, his movies are inhabited by odd representations of the male and female sexes. The women definitely all have big bosoms, and as time went on, had not only huge, but, I mean, frightening bosoms. I mean, it just got amped up to a degree that, as I think I put it in the book, eventually, you know, they became candidates for medical textbooks, not anything most of us maybe would associate with hot stuff. But at any rate, you have these very aggressive, demanding, just insanely driven and voracious women, and then you have the square jaws, which are these men who there are usually two kind of figures of men in Meyer's films, and then the one who definitely didn't have a square jaw, it was invariably the husband who was being put upon by a wife with voracious sexuality that he could never satisfy, and this poor sap seems oblivious to her sexuality and incapable of satisfying her. And it's just a vicious picture of matrimony, in my opinion. And then you have guys like Charles Napier, who starred in some of his pictures, notably Cherry, Harry, and Raquel and Super Vixens. Boy, what a square jaw. Just playing these kind of psychopathic, amoral, diabolical guys who are out to take what they can get from the women, and the whole thing, it's amped up in a very violent and malevolent way, and I don't know if I explained it very well, but that gives you kind of a thumbnail of the characters in a Meyer movie.
Well, and it just wasn't the characters in these movies. It's sort of how he thought of life.
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say so, definitely. And if you read the book, I think there's ample evidence that, yeah, indeed, this was no, you know, distant satire from his brain. This was really the way he saw life and lived it and behaved it and how he experienced people in it. And I think the more you study it, the more unusual it becomes. And the more you kind of delve into his life, the more resonant it becomes for all the oddness that is there.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, he started his movie career with The Immoral Mr. Tease, which was one of these groundbreaking films in that it basically started a whole genre of film called The Nudie Cutie.
Right.
That was infinitely imitated.
Yes.
And then he moved on to this darker period. That's quite a transition.
Yeah, no, I know. This is the great thing about Meyer. He was almost like an ad man with a product. It was like, well, you know, I've kind of exhausted this area. Now the great Meyer must take it into a new area, heretofore unseen, you know? I mean, it was great the way he just sort of, cliched expression, but reinvented himself, and he really did do it. And with this picture, Lorna, Mudhoney, Faster Pussycat, which I named, Motor Psycho, these were really very hard-boiled, down-and-dirty pictures, very, very grim, tough, and nothing like them, boy. I just think they're fantastic.
Well, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which you've mentioned, is probably the best of his films. A lot of people will argue it's the best of his films.
Right.
And it is a film that is also very much like a Russ Meyer film, but also very much unlike a Russ Meyer film.
Absolutely true, yeah. There's more going on in that picture, and boy, had Meyer been around to probe into his brain, I'd really like to know where that one came from, because it's so kind of, it's got all the elements of the other ones, but it's way out there.
There's violence, there's sex, there's fast cars. There's,
yeah,
like all this tension and hip language and fast edits and
yeah. And I think a couple of things he benefited from were this guy John Moran, who wrote the screenplay for that, and a couple of other fantastic. He just had the gift of gab, man. This guy could nail the dialogue in a way that just had you shaking your head in wonder. And Richard Brummer, who came into the editing room and had experience in the art film area in New York, who amped up Meyer's editing style, showed him how to overlap dialogue. And really, if you look at the pictures that came before that, Faster Pussycat, man, it's just like, you know, he's just he switched gears and the engine's smoking, and it's a beautiful thing to watch.
And it's
there's
actually
no picture like it.
No, there isn't, and it is. It does have that art house quality because it's filmed in black and white, or as he liked to call it, filmed in black and blue.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah,
it does have that art film quality while being this out and out exploitation film too.
I know. It's just sublime. It's such a combination of the high and low and left and right. And, you know, people who love that picture, you know, they really love it. And, boy, I'm one of them, definitely.
Well, then he moves on to back to color film, gorgeous color film.
Right.
And, as you said, amps up that sex and violence with films like, well, like Vixen.
Right.
Which was his next big hit.
Right. Yeah, Vixen is really, if you look at the script, it's kind of unremarkable in my opinion. It's kind of, you know, Meyer just grabs a former actor in a previous film and, you know, write this and, you know, probably locked him in a hotel room for 5 days and gave him, you know, $250. But it just benefits from the incorrigible presence of Eric Hagavin, who just is a presence like no other. It's so sad to me that she only made a few pictures and didn't make any more, because she's just, you know, she's a live wire. And there's something about the color in that picture. You can feel the sweat. It's a great document of the time. Really great. And made so much money. Just barrelfuls of money.
Earlier, you brought up the name of Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
A man who's actually very important to this area because he was born and grew up in this area and comes back every year to do a film festival.
Right.
How did he and Russ Meyer connect, get together?
Yeah. How did they, Jason? Well, Roger, being a great film fan, knew about Meyer from, you know, the days of the Immoral Mr. Tease. And when Wall Street Journal did a profile on Meyer, really the emphasis was, you know, look at how much money this guy's making, being the Wall Street Journal, you know, by investing $1.98 and, you know, returning a thousandfold on that. But it was a cred, that article. It really kind of shined a light in what had, you know, previously been an area, you know, most of America would best consider under a rock. And Ebert wrote a letter, you know, saying, comparing Meyer to all these grand directors and saying, you know, it's about time Hollywood turned him loose. Well, Meyer, who was never one to miss anybody who loved him, got in touch with Ebert, and shortly thereafter, when Meyer was invited to 20th Century Fox, who but Ebert did he invite to write the script? And it has to be said, and both men have certainly said it, they both had a penchant for the same sort of big balcony dames, and that certainly sealed the deal, welded the friendship between RM and RE, as it were.
Well, what was the experience like for Russ Meyer in the big studio system?
Well, I think it was very good initially because, you know, he had everybody at his beck and call. I mean, amazingly, Zanuck and Brown, the producers there, Richard Zanuck, who was then head of the studio, and the studio was in trouble financially. They'd had all these big pictures that just went belly up. And they read this thing in the Wall Street Journal and thought, well, if this guy can get a return like that and times are changing, why don't we, you know, see what he can do for us? And they really gave him the keys to the kingdom. They gave him a big pile of loot. They said, go make your movie and bring it back to us. And, you know, I mean, for a former smut peddler to sort of be given, you know, for them to shine the Hollywood throne and say, sit here and what can we get you, sire? It's unbelievable. I mean, it really is. And unfortunately, though, after that picture, I think instead of making what would be a Russ Meyer picture, he sort of went the other direction and sort of aped a Hollywood picture by making this picture, The 7 Minutes, which, it has to be said, was kind of forced upon him. But it was this ponderous anti-censorship story based on a novel by Irving Wallace. And it had all the you know, he's never going to make a picture without talent. But it just, it really tanked. And that was definitely, other projects were discussed, but he left the studio soon after. And it's too bad that he couldn't have you know, made a few more pictures in his own style, who knows what would have happened. But the fact that he got away with one of them to the extent he did, it's just marvelous. And, you know, that's another picture. You mentioned that, and people, you know, they get all hushed and reverent and swoon because it means so much to the people who are into it.
Well, within the last decade or so, the cult status of Russ Meyer has really grown.
Oh, yeah. And I think it will continue. I hope it will continue to grow. Just because he's just one of these guys. He's just an American original. I mean, you say Russ Meyer picture and people, you know, people either applaud or vomit. I mean, they have an extreme reaction because there's nobody like the guy. And especially in this day and age where everything seems to be Batman 7 and Fantastic Four number 23. You know, not that there's anything wrong with those mega monster, you know, Hollywood cookie cutter, you know, movies. I mean, you look at something like Meyer, and he's just really like this, you know, this guy out there with his camera, his strippers, his army buddies, you know, and he's going to make a movie, no matter what. And, you know, I think people can look at it and get wistful for a lot of things that are harder and harder to find in America.
That was Jimmy McDonough, author of a new biography of filmmaker Russ Meyer titled Big Bosoms and Square Jaws. It's published by Crown Books. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website. And a lot of our past shows are also available as MP3 downloads. Just go to will.uiuc.edu, click Listen, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.